Chapter 3, Hidden Life. Jesus' public life was deeply rooted in his hidden life. Jesus could not have improvised his way of being. He had to grow up, just like any person, because he was truly a man, and since all people carry their experience with them, Jesus must have also carried his hidden life with him, as a formative part of his being. How did Jesus come to be Jesus? The incarnation is not just the event by which Jesus took on a human body, but rather the process by which Jesus took up the task of becoming a person, i.e., a man, because the only way to become a man is by being a human person. We use the word person here in its psychological sense, not in its metaphysical, Trinitarian sense. Jesus discovered himself little by little, in relationship with his parents, his home, his world, his times. Jesus was not a man in general, he was this man. He belonged to a people, and lived in a specific time and specific circumstances. The conditions of his life were unique, and made Jesus unique. He wished to take up the task that he was presented with in the world, and from the perspective of his being and his circumstances, he approached the world and carried out his mission. Jesus wanted to be what he was. Jesus gradually learned to understand his life from God's perspective. In this stage of his hidden life, the most important thing that Jesus did was to construct himself and his personality from God's perspective. God's will was that he should exist in this world and be who he was. One of the fundamental points of the events of Jesus' hidden life is how God gave a direction to his life, his consciousness, and his experiences. Jesus would not have come to be what he was without this orientation of his entire being toward God. Why was Jesus the way he was? The answer to this question can be found in the immediate circumstances in which he lived. Jesus was not prefabricated, his world shaped him gradually as he grew. In a second sense, this question can be asked on a deeper, more personal level. In this case, the answer is because it was Jesus in those particular circumstances. Finally, we can identify God as the primary source sustaining Jesus' humanity. God had Jesus be Jesus in his particular circumstances. One especially valuable way to understand Jesus is from the perspective of our own life. If we really appreciated our own experience as a source of knowledge, our understanding would be more enlightening and less theoretical, and the study of Jesus would lead to a recognition of ourselves. When people live their own experiences deeply, they are more capable of understanding Jesus. Jesus, just like us, underwent many things that he was unaware of, but that did not make them any less important as part of his personal development. The prenatal stage of his life established an intimate relationship with his mother, in terms of physical growth. His birth represented a rupture and a liberation, and he began his existence as an individual. This rupture and liberation from the womb, when it takes place at the proper time, is as life-giving as the union with the mother in the intrauterine stage. Birth separates the child from the mother. The challenge consists of making sure this separation is real and complete, while at the same time giving the child proper guidance. The child must be taught how to live, because it starts out utterly helpless. Jesus had to get used to his individual existence. He had to learn to walk instead of being carried. He had to learn to feed himself, instead of being fed. He had to learn to act according to his own ideas, instead of being taken by the hand. From a genetic perspective, parenthood consists of engendering and giving life. But from a more human perspective, which considers all of a person's many facets, parenthood implies care, continuity, and responsibility in the child's development. We cannot speak of real human parenthood if there is no care or responsibility for the new person's development, regardless of genetic parenthood. Human parenthood is naturally based more on consciousness, freedom, and responsibility than on the marital relation that procreated the new life. The genetic relationship can even be inhuman when the whole person is not nurtured. A paternal relationship that involves long-term nurturing, protection, and responsibility, on the other hand, is the real mark of a genuine father or mother. Parents are so necessary and important because they form the bridge between the child and the world. The shock of entering the world is so great that in the absence of parents, it would be fatal. The world is so hostile that without parents, a child would have no idea of how to fend for itself. Absolutely everything is unknown. That is why children are forever asking questions. And parents are the ones to give the first answers. These answers, often inaccurate, are the only real ones for children, because they are the only ones that they can understand. Parents create the nurturing setting that children need. Parents are authority, protection, and loving self-sacrifice. It was only because Jesus had the personal experience of a fine father that he could call God Father. From this perspective, the issue of Joseph's parenthood takes on special importance. The church has always known that Jesus was not an orphan, he did not lack a father figure. In fact, this figure was perhaps the key element in the development of Jesus' understanding of his relationship with God. Joseph, far from stifling Jesus' trust in God, was the one who inspired and nurtured it. God, in his proximity, does not destroy Joseph or take his place. On the contrary, he makes Joseph more autonomous and more himself. Jesus learned from Joseph everything a boy learns from his father: how to work, how to fulfill his religious obligations, how to be sociable and humble, how to serve and not be served. Joseph is projected in Jesus. Responsibility for education is an ongoing confirmation of human parenthood, and even more, the actual realization of human parenthood, because the important thing for the human person is not just to come into the world, but to learn how to live there. The evangelists clearly took care to conceal the figure of Joseph. It is simply not convincing that they would know more details about the Annunciation to Mary than about Joseph's influence in Jesus' upbringing. Moreover, the argument that Joseph died when Jesus was young cannot be easily sustained. Jesus' spiritual attitude, his teachings and parables, suggest that Joseph's father figure left an indelible mark on his existence. Jesus would not have spoken about the father who breaks bread for his children, of the head of the family who sleeps in the same bed with his children, of the prodigal son, if he had lacked a father figure. Jesus learned from Mary everything a boy learns from his mother: how to walk, to talk, to eat, to take care of himself, to have friends and get along with others, to understand the scriptures according to the categories of the time, to understand his own mission on the basis of the scriptures and his own deep and extraordinarily contemplative reflection and prayer. Jesus grew. Jesus grew in wisdom and grace. He slowly penetrated God's mystery and the mystery of his own person. To grow in wisdom means to make the great values of Israel more and more personal and internally motivated. To grow in grace before God means that every day, Jesus was the object of God's complete love, that God was pleased with him. Just as we can say that a father loves his child more and more, without implying that at the end he has something that he lacked at the beginning, in the same way we can say that Jesus gradually became, and revealed himself to be, the center of God's affection. To grow in grace before men means that Jesus day by day made himself beloved of people. Jesus Christ depended on others not just for the satisfaction of his material needs, but above all, and more profoundly, on a spiritual level. Like all children, by discovering others he discovered his own existence and unique value. He learned to give of himself to others, and by giving of himself, he revealed himself to others and to himself. By receiving others and giving of himself to them, Jesus lived what he was. Jesus grew, and became a person psychologically. Jesus increased his knowledge, his freedom, and his love. Jesus Christ is the response to the Father and to us, and he made himself by responding. He is the response to salvific action, and he made himself by saving us. He himself is the Father's response. His entire being is the expression of the Father, and in his life, his whole person is the yes of the Father, the fulfillment of all his promises. Jesus Christ gradually learned, without compromising his freedom, to be everything he already was from the beginning, and he lived it in his hidden life as the incarnated God. In his response, Jesus took on the meaning of his being, his life, and his actions. Jesus little by little learned to be more aware, to be more present to himself, to know himself better. If he posed the question, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" it was because he had asked himself the same question many times, and had an answer. Jesus Christ, as the incarnate God, learned to take his place in relation to other people and the universe. He, in the scope of his history, did not make reality, but accepted it, and by accepting it, transformed it, because a person can only transform something when he in some way accepts it. Jesus gradually learned to love the Father above any personal satisfaction. His center of gravity was his response to the Father, in freedom and in love. Jesus Christ came to be what he was by committing himself, by receiving and loving others. Jesus learned to be not just for himself and for the Father, but also for others. He learned to take others in, to communicate, and to receive the communication of others. During his hidden life, his mother must have had a very significant influence. She taught him to store up things in his heart and to meditate on them. He knew that both new and old things can come out of the heart. Jesus made himself richer with the riches of others, but without taking anything away from them. By seeing what others were and accepting them, he came to know himself and to accept others. Jesus learned that love for Yahweh with all one's heart and all one's strength had to be expressed as love of neighbor, because this commandment is simply the incarnation of the first one. Jesus learned to love everyone, and with this same love he loved the Father who is present in others. Jesus learned that the way to serve the Father is by serving others, and that is why he came to serve. Jesus also learned that neither this world nor other people were as they should be. Not even he was as he had to be, he needed to grow, just as the world and other people needed to grow. Jesus had to learn the painful lesson of suffering others, of understanding them, being loyal and sincere to them, of admiring their values. He learned to look not just at the surface, but at the heart of things. The reality of things and the value of people are perceived by the heart. The only thing one can really know deep down is what one loves. And it is by loving that one learns what love is. Jesus learned that in everything there is something of beauty, of goodness, and of truth, but he did not stop there, dazzled, but related it always to the Father. The reference to the Father was for Jesus the greatest value that all things contained. And all this he learned in his love for others, in a certain sense they were telling him. Love becomes real when people move beyond themselves. No love is more disinterested than that which offers itself. Human love is not an instinctive drive, but a conscious and freely chosen impulse. Love is the offering of oneself projected toward the other. Jesus gradually came to know himself and to accept himself as the incarnate God, and that is how he offers himself to us to be known and accepted. When he made the ultimate gift, it was ultimate generosity. Jesus' ultimate gift was to give himself to the Father who is present in others. A man can have no greater love than to lay down his life for his friends. Jesus learned to move beyond himself to accept and love others, and to offer himself to them. Jesus learned that it is possible to love others in order to make use of them, but that this is the way to destroy others, to obliterate their dignity and their value as persons. Jesus learned to love others not for himself, but to love himself for others. He loves the Father by loving others, and by loving others he loves himself. Jesus learned, in the intimacy of his family, that love is manifested in unity. That is why the Father and he are one and the same, and why he invites us to a communion of life with him, and he tells us that eternal life means being where he is. From the love of his parents, Jesus learned that love consists of the communion of life, and that is why he taught us to form a family. He came to realize that union is not confusion, not a mixing, but a communion of persons that relates them to one another while respecting their individuality. Mixing destroys the elements, union affirms the person. Love completes a person's personality, and in love, the person is affirmed. Love of oneself comes before love for others, but it is in the other that love is found and where it has its meaning. It is thus possible to love another more than oneself. Jesus, by loving, grew in love, and by offering himself, he grew in generosity, because this offering, which is love, is rooted in the deepest part of human persons, it is their expression. Jesus learned to love others through signs in which he, like us, wished to make himself present. But his signs, like ours, by their very virtue of being signs and not disclosing their whole meaning, can be betrayed. Jesus is a question, and he made himself by questioning himself. He is the greatest gift, and he made himself by giving himself. He grew in his love, in his generosity, in his fidelity to the Father and to us. Jesus grew. He was a man in the process of becoming. He, who proceeds completely from the Father, was the author of his own development. Upon becoming a man, he underwent everything that is involved in becoming a person. One is sometimes tempted to think that children are beings in the process of becoming adults, as if their only reason for being was to grow up. Children are there to be children, and as children, persons. Human beings are persons in all the stages of their lives. Jesus came to this world not just to grow into an adult, but also to be a child. His childhood was not just a time of preparation. One walks not just to reach a destination, but to spend one's life walking. In the overall life of Jesus, his childhood was of capital importance for his personality. In every moment of a human life, the life as a whole is present. Life is not just a succession of parts, it is a whole. The final point in Jesus' growth and evolution is the Jesus we know from the Gospel, a Jesus who already knows how to relate to others freely and responsibly, who thinks and acts for himself. In order to highlight Jesus' relationship with God as a Father, we focus on the features that indicate dependence, but it is also important to keep in mind that a father engenders a child so that, like him, it will come to be a free and independent person. A father realizes himself as a father when he has a child who is like him, independent. Jesus' relationship with God as a father is based on Jesus' whole personality, not just on a relationship of origin. It is based on his dependence and independence, in other words, on the ongoing response that was his whole life, fully aware, free, and responsible. God let Jesus be Jesus. And at the same time, God as Creator and Father, is the root and source out of which Jesus became Jesus. Jesus' childhood. Being a child means being dependent, needy, contingent on another person. As a child, Jesus proceeds not just from his Father God, but also from other human beings. This is the meaning of the genealogies that situate Jesus within the history of salvation, and it is also the meaning of Mary's motherhood and Jesus' relationship with Joseph. Jesus developed in Mary's womb, and from her he received his blood, his heartbeat, his way of being, and a great number of genes that throughout his hidden life, shaped him to become the Jesus that he was. What is one's own thus comes from what belongs to others. But one's own is not just biological, the family, as well as human and cultural contexts, are at least as important. This means that Jesus received his way of thinking, looking at things, praying, etc., from those who came before him. No one is so original that she can do without the past. Jesus' originality consists of interpreting the facts of history from God's perspective. It is noteworthy that Jesus assigned such an important role to childhood in human realization. I tell you solemnly that unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. For Jesus, childhood was not just a stage that is then erased without leaving a trace. On the contrary, childhood encompasses the essence of being human and being a Christian to such an extent that whoever has lost the essence of childhood is somehow maimed. All of this suggests how happy Jesus must have been in his childhood. The memory of Jesus' childhood pervades the entire gospel. Jesus' childhood years permeate his message. He never would have said what he said about children if his own childhood had been an existential struggle, or if the values that make a person a human being had been missing. Jesus did not see children in terms of their future. He did not care much about theories or educational systems for making adults out of children. Jesus valued children as children. And what are these values of childhood that Jesus found so compelling, we might ask? Childhood occupies such an important place in Jesus' preaching because it has to do with his own personal mystery, his relationship with God. His greatest dignity does not derive from his power, or his authority, or his message, but from his relationship with God. He is, above all, the Son, and God is his Father. It must be remembered that Jesus' hidden life was not just his childhood, but also his adolescence, his years as a young man, his whole process of development and growth. And what conditioned Jesus was not just his childhood, but the process as such. His adolescence and youth must have been as determining as his early childhood. If not, we would find evidence in the gospel suggesting otherwise. What should be stored up from childhood for all of one's life is its most intimate core, the reference to another. Thus, a Christian's filial existence, lived as Jesus lived it, always refers us to God as Father. Even when one reaches adulthood, in fact, in order to reach adulthood, one must maintain the filial mindset that is characteristic of the child. Children in the Jewish family. Children were subject to contrasting sentiments in the Jewish culture. On the one hand, they were seen as one of the main signs of divine blessing, so they were loved more than in many other peoples and cultures, and surrounded by care and affection. They were rubbed with salt and wrapped in swaddling clothes at birth. If it was a boy, he was circumcised on the eighth day. If it was the firstborn, it was consecrated to God after 30 days and redeemed. It was redeemed because the firstborn was in a special way Yahweh's property, and represented the entire family. Mothers nursed their children for 3 years. During this time, the child was a babe in arms. Children who could walk helped out with household chores, and were associated with women, so that women and children practically represented a social category. At around 4 years of age, a boy was given the tasseled cloak. 1 year later, his father taught him to read the sacred books. In some cases the boys were sent to a teacher, who taught small groups of boys. At the age of 12, the boy was presented or introduced to the religious community and received the phylacteries. The following Sabbath, he made his first reading of the law in the synagogue. On the other hand, children were insignificant in social life, just as among other ancient peoples. Their job was to listen and learn. They were expected to recognize their elders at all times and serve them. In the eyes of their elders, children barely figured. Not much time was spent, for example, on taking care of them. One of the first things they had to learn was to greet the rabbi respectfully. "Peace be with you," was the greeting among equals, but when it was a rabbi or a teacher, the child had to say, "Peace be with you, my professor or teacher." An Israelite man had to wear a phylactery on his forehead and another tied to his left arm during morning prayers, and recite the following prayer. "Blessed be Yahweh, God, King of the universe, you who have sanctified us with your commandments and have ordered us to wear your phylacteries." The imposition of the phylacteries must have been quite an event in a boy's spiritual experience. He must have felt he was the personal bearer of Yahweh's revelation and promises. Some Jews wore their phylacteries all day and lengthened the ribbons with which they were tied, in order to draw attention to themselves. Jesus would later criticize this attitude, which reveals pretentiousness more than it does a love for the Lord's precepts. There is no doubt that Jesus was brought up with all of these signs of Jewish religiosity. The continual prayer of good Israelites must have given him the experience of continual communion with God. Ablutions were also very common. They were a ritual washing of hands and feet as a sign of religious purification. Jesus practiced these purification rites. In his dialogue with Simon the Pharisee, he remarks on the lack of water for normal ablutions. At the beginning of his public life, he received baptism from John, and he himself administered it later. Jesus would later criticize people's obsession with these external purification rites, saying that it is not what comes from outside that makes people unclean, but the evil intentions that come out of their heart. The celebration of the family rite of Passover must have made a lasting impression on children. They played an important role in the celebration, and their questions about the meaning of the actions formed part of the rite. The solemn feasts must have been memorable, especially when they implied making the trip to Jerusalem in the midst of throngs of pilgrims. The story of young Jesus lost in the temple reflects the strong impact that this kind of experience must have made on children. We can be sure that Jesus carefully observed all the prescriptions that referred to resting on the Sabbath, and we can assume that it was this scrupulousness that led him, as an adult, to put their value into proper perspective. Children always assumed an attitude of trustful openness, of willingness to learn. They had nothing to offer of their own, and limited themselves to obeying. It was their place to receive gratefully whatever they were given. Children were weak people, without pretensions, and their humility was more social than subjective. Most of the gospel texts that present children as models of humility and simplicity in Christian life are referring to this aspect of childhood. In this sense, childhood is emblematic of an attitude of poverty and simplicity toward God and the proclamation of the kingdom. Jesus' sexuality. What do we know of Jesus' sexuality? Can we say that Jesus serves as a real model and ideal for our own sexual development and maturity? Are there any hints in the gospel that could help to form a reasonable judgment in this area? What might Jesus have experienced, and what did he think about people's sexual development and their sexual life? Catholics who are respectful of Jesus and of the Church's teachings no doubt find this a difficult issue to approach. The questions seem almost irreverent. If in general a certain modesty surrounds any discussion of human sexuality in general, this modesty increases when Jesus enters the picture. Very few theological treatises include as much as a footnote on the subject. Our reflections, therefore, will be brief. And the bibliography that we can offer is practically non-existent. Unfortunately, we cannot find rigorously historical information in the Gospels. Jesus' hidden life becomes doubly hidden as far as his personal development and growth are concerned, and even more so in terms of his sexuality. This, however, does not mean that Jesus did not undergo a healthy and genuine sexual development as a specifically male human being. The evangelists take for granted that Jesus' development was the same as any other human person's, except that it was free of sin. The fact that our sexual development is often fraught with anxiety does not justify denying Jesus' own growth, or imposing a silence that only serves to keep Jesus remote from our real-life experience and to make us imagine him as an asexual being. It can be assumed that in Jesus' time a young person's sexual development was not accompanied by the same turbulence as it is nowadays. This arises more out of the environment we find ourselves immersed in than from the nature of growth and inner vitality. A person's sexual development does not necessarily demand that he undergo all the various difficulties that we have experienced. There is no reason to doubt Jesus' own affective and sexual development, or to imagine him as a being who is aloof from our sexuality, or from his identity as a male human being. In his public life, Jesus showed himself as a man who expressed his love by means of a generous and fulfilling mission, the kingdom of heaven, which included service to God and neighbor. His being was completely possessed by the kingdom, which put him on a different plane. The same thing has happened to other people who devote themselves fully to a certain ideal. S. Proudhon said to Marx, "In this day and age it is a luxury to want justice and love a woman." Jesus was a man who was totally polarized by the kingdom. His celibacy cannot be construed as a disparagement of women or a slighting of human and family values. What it does mean is a radical identification with the kingdom, with his mission. For Jesus, women were not a trap, or a temptation, or deceit. Jesus thought the kingdom should open up to all his disciples a different way of seeing and living their sexuality, so that women cease to be considered an occasion of sin and become genuine disciples and friends of his and of his disciples. The Old Testament makes a positive assessment of sexuality and interpersonal relationships. Jesus did not move away from this vision. He had no complexes regarding love, sexuality, or women. He had no trouble quoting Genesis to refer to men's and women's need for a sexual complement. Jesus was fully aware of interpersonal love between a man and a woman, and approved of it. Moreover, he considered it so valuable that it should last forever. The indissolubility of marriage shows just how far Jesus went in valuing human love. The marital relationship between a man and a woman was something that Jesus valued in and of itself as two people's original commitment to love and complementarity, with a clear allusion to love, whereby the two leave their parents and join together to form one flesh. Regarding love, sensitivity, and sexual activity, Jesus not only is not scandalized, nor does he take the moralizing and scrupulous tack of the Pharisees, but he addresses the subject with complete equanimity, neither dodging the topic nor giving it undue importance. It is important to point that Jesus, unlike the Essenes, did not encourage or demand his disciples to reject women, or to carry out special purification rites after sexual activity. Jesus assumes and accepts, in fact he expects and demands an attitude of responsibility and freedom toward women. Jesus' true disciples should act as he did. In order to understand Jesus' attitude toward women and toward his own sexual development, it is helpful to imagine what it means to be a man possessed by an ideal, who devotes himself full-time and with all his heart to doing God's will. Jesus not only transcended what another person might consider to be perfectly natural with regard to human love and sexual development, he also expressed his mission in his lifestyle as a celibate, fulfilled man. By taking on human nature, Jesus took on a being that was numerically singular, alive, specific, concrete, and determined by circumstances. He assumed it as part of his process of becoming a man, and this man, who was Jesus, was determined by his biological, psychological, and social sexuality, which led to his being specifically male. Jesus was not an abstract human being, he was a man. His sexuality, like that of all people, was not an afterthought, or something that could be left behind. His sexuality, in addition to being a biological function with all of its specific characteristics, was first and foremost a defining principle of his personal being. It was also a principle of otherness, of difference, and of reference to all the other people he encountered. Psychology has discovered a close relationship between sexuality and love, tenderness, gentleness, trust, mercy, self-esteem, and self-confidence. Only people who are sure of themselves can open up to others with an attitude of service, generosity, and respect. In the value they find in others, they discover, understand, and project the value of their own person. Sexuality gives rise to a way of being that is tender, gentle, affectionate, trusting, and merciful. In fact, these characteristics are the expression of sexuality. Sexuality is one of our strongest drives. It motivates us to discover our own particular personality. Jesus, like all people, was driven by his sexuality to discover his particular way of relating to God, to women, and to other people in general. Jesus' experience of God, the author of the kingdom that Jesus announced, and his tremendous freedom in dealing with the status quo, led him to seek out women of tarnished reputation and announce to them the time of grace. His relationship with them was not distant or superficial, but intimate and committed. While recognizing that, because of their sins they deserved the last place, he declared that by accepting the kingdom, they would enter even before the saints, the righteous, the dutiful, and those who count on their good works. It is also important to point out that although Jesus assigned sexuality its full value, he did not believe it has significance in eternal life. Their men will be like the angels in heaven.